First Amendment freedoms, and government transparency. This is the foundation to a healthy democracy. Welcome to the NEFAC Report, where we discuss your rights to free speech, freedom of the press, and an open, accountable government. I'm Alexandra Tavallone, production manager for the NEFAC Report and part of a student team at Roger Williams University working with the New England First Amendment Coalition. Thanks for joining us. On this episode, Justin speaks with NEFAC mentor and Boston University professor Megan Irons about the vital role student journalists play in our communities. Megan will also describe for us the unique challenges that these young journalists are facing as they break into the profession. Later in the show, we'll hear from senior legal counsel for the Student Press Law Center, Mike Hastened. Mike will talk about a Tufts University student who was detained by federal immigration authorities because of an op-ed that she wrote, and why this should alarm us all. But first, here's Justin and Megan.
Hey, Megan, thanks for being here. You've had a long career in journalism, 20 plus years at the Boston Globe, where you worked with the elite spotlight team. You're now teaching at Boston University and giving a lot of your time to our NEFAC Mentors program. So you have this really great perspective on not just professional journalism, but student journalism. So let's start there. What is the state of student journalism right now, and what are some of the challenges they might be facing?
Thank you for having me, Justin. It's such a great honor to be here. And I want to say that I'm very inspired by young people because they still want to go into our business. And that's really telling given the climate that we're living in right now and the assault that we're seeing on our profession and the people who do this work. So the things I'm inspired by are students who come into my class, and I teach a class called In-Depth Reporting, where students fill a gap in a local community. I'm inspired that they want to learn how to be good journalists. They want to learn how to do journalism ethically. They want to learn how to be purveyor of news and facts and the truth, but also to be respectful of the people they cover, particularly people who are often disparaged in the media. So on that level, it is very optimistic. But I also feel that some of the student journalists that I have come across are also very stressed out. They're stressed out by the barrage of what they see as assault on our profession. They feel under siege in some regards. And they're also worried about their future prospects in terms of, will they be able to get an internship and will they be able to get a job? The journalism itself remains strong. Just take a quick sweep across the country and see where student journalists are making a huge impact. They are not only filling a void in local communities like some of my students are doing, but they're also breaking big news. You and I have been in this business a long time. We've seen these moments of great despair, and we've also seen moments of great triumph. And I do believe in what we do. And I do believe that eventually this journalism is going to survive the moment that we're in right now, and student journalists will be leading the way.
They have to. We're really relying on them in ways that we haven't before, right? I think of my own town. I live in a small town just west of Boston. Years ago, we lost our weekly newspaper. We don't have a lot of the news sources that we once did. So what are we doing? We often go to the homepage of the high school student newspaper to read stories about what's going on in our community. These student journalists, and I know you're working with college students at BU, but student journalists at all levels are really filling this void, aren't they?
Yes. You know, I have a similar story out of Andover. Andover at one point had two viable local newspapers, and then it just vanished, creating a huge vacuum for news. So where they, you know, folks in Andover could look at the Boston Globe or look at television news, they weren't getting the real hyper-local granular stuff. And so I guess this year, Andover News relaunched this year as a nonprofit newsroom. And before then, there was only one person writing everything about Andover. My students, I teach 10 students in a class called Reporting in Depth. And we have been flooding Andover, covering the local government, covering the issues that are of interest in the community. We've written about the fact that fewer Democrats voted in the last election than previous years. We're looking at the data. In some cases, I feel like the town is a little bit shocked that, you know, there are eyes and ears on what they're doing. One of my students recently, just this week, produced a story about how a lot of the meetings are online. And that can be very limiting for people who don't have the right technology or who have a preference of being in person where there's so many opportunities to connect with people in real time. So we are doing those really important work in areas where journalism was thriving and is thriving no longer. And this is where I see student journalists being so instrumental in filling those gaps, offering newspapers that lack the finances to hire multiple people to cover their local government, but offering them talented journalists who are out there looking at the issues in the various communities. The other thing that BU has launched that I want to mention is a burgeoning newsroom where we are partnering with multiple nonprofit newsrooms across New England. And that's separate from what I do in my class. And so right now, students are working for newspapers in Springfield, in Waltham, in Brookline, just all over Massachusetts and around the area, and producing really good, solid journalism that had been missing in the years prior to our involvement. So once again, I'll say I'm very inspired to see that students want to come to university and learn journalism and learn the craft. They're very interested in trying to be the next generation of news leaders and newsmakers, but they're also providing invaluable resources to local news organizations that really need it.
You and your colleagues are doing some fantastic work at BU. I should mention that Boston University is a major supporter of ours. I'd like you to speak for a moment to those students that maybe aren't at a large journalism institution, maybe don't have the resources that BU does. Maybe they're in high school and they're actually still wondering, is journalism right for me given the current environment? What would you say to them to really encourage them to get into the profession and to emphasize just how necessary they are?
Yes, not only young people are asking these questions, but seasoned veterans are asking those questions, right? But what I would say to a young person who's interested in this is just to be curious. You are a person in this world and you should care about your fellow man, right? That's what journalism is at its essence: empathy, curiosity, wanting to see people do the right thing, particularly for others who are vulnerable. These are issues that you care about: holding government to account, making sure that information is delivered to the public in a way that they can make really great informed decisions. If those are issues that you care about, this is a profession for you. It's not an easy profession, so you have to love it and you have to work at it and you get better at it. And so I would say, just to borrow a phrase, keep hope alive. This is a profession that has withstood the test of time, and I am very optimistic for the future of journalism. And I also say too that you don't have to be in a huge program like ours to get introduced to this work. There are newspapers in your communities, most of them digital now. If you have a story idea, just go ahead and pitch it. I don't think they're going to say you're in high school or you're in college and we don't want this idea. I think they'd be happy to have an extra eye and ear, reporting the news or events that are happening in your neighborhood. So there are lots of like little newspapers that are popping up. Pitch a story, go meet the editor, talk to a reporter, do your research and get connected with the folks who are doing the work, but also get connected with your own love for truth and storytelling. I think those are the two things that are really key.
That's great advice. And I would also add, as another way to support yourself, apply for a NEFAC mentorship. We have this
That's
program called NEFAC Mentors that was launched a couple of years ago. And the idea is to pair all journalists, but mostly early career journalists, with a mentor over the course of 6 months. And the mentorship would focus on a specific area of need that that particular journalist has. So we've had mentorships that have been very technical, where journalists will learn a particular piece of software over the course of the mentorship. Some are more general, focus on career advice and so forth. Megan, you've been a really important part of this program and have served as a mentor for an early career journalist. Tell us a little bit about your experience.
Yes, it's a very exciting pairing. I'm paired with Jacob Downey, who's a young journalist, and he's just a very amazing young man who started his own newspaper at his college, which is awesome, and did some really, dare I say, badass work. holding his college administration to account. We've met a few times and we communicate periodically. And one of the things he's trying to do is break into the business, beef up his resume so that he can eventually get a job where he's doing this full time. He's working for like a hyperlocal newspaper right now. So we've worked on mapping out a game plan for how he could broaden his network, for instance. Building a story list is another one. Talking through ideas. And I was just really inspired by his tenacity, and the fact that he, on his own and through the help of other students, obviously, was able to build that newspaper at his old college called The Clock, and that he's still very interested in pursuing journalism. He's doing something else now, but so he wants to make journalism his full-time job. So we've been just sort of talking through how to do that well. And I think this is really important that, somebody like myself, I've been in the business for now 30 plus years. It's been a long time. But it's really important that we really connect with young people, not just, in class or over coffee, but really give back to people who are trying to break into a tough, tough market. And so it's been a great partnership, I think, and I'm enjoying myself, and I hope he is too.
I'm sure he is. He's very fortunate to have you as a mentor, and we are very fortunate to have you as part of the program. I would encourage everyone to take a look at the program itself, NEFAC Mentors. You can find more information at nefac.org/mentors. Megan, thanks so much for being here today. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you, Justin, and good luck.
Hi, I'm David Cicilline from the Rhode Island Foundation. As Rhode Island's only community foundation, we mobilize generosity and motivate change that makes a difference. As a longtime supporter of the New England First Amendment Coalition, the Rhode Island Foundation is committed to enhancing access to trusted news and information sources and supporting trusted independent local journalism. The Rhode Island Foundation, only together can we create progress that lasts.
Hey. This is Alexandra again. If you want to learn more about the topics being discussed in this episode, please take a look at our show notes. A link is provided wherever you're listening to this podcast. These notes include NEFAC resources, research about the power of student journalism, and so much more. Now, let's hear from Mike Haston about the Tufts University student who was detained by U.S. immigration authorities for writing an op-ed in her campus newspaper.
Thanks for being here, Mike. Appreciate it. I'm going to have you talk in a minute about the case of this Tufts student, Rumaysa Ozturk, her detention, the statement that we at NEFAC, along with the Student Press Law Center and a number of other national organizations, released regarding her detention. But first, your organization, the Student Press Law Center, took the unprecedented step of releasing a student media alert. What was the alert all about and what prompted you to send this out?
Yeah, this is something that we at the SPLC, and we were joined by pretty much every, national journalism education group in the country in issuing this alert. But it's just a recognition, that the times seem to have changed and the rules seem to have changed. It's a direct response to what happened at Tufts University, where Rumaysa was part of an op-ed that was published last March. It's been up for an entire year, and there's a reason it's been up for an entire year without any sort of pushback or anything like that, because it is entirely lawful. Before what's happened recently, it was understood to be fully protected speech. And so our understanding, we kept waiting for more information to drop. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, came out after she was, pulled off the street and whisked down to Louisiana. He's fully comfortable with what happened here, that she was involved in what he called terroristic activity, terroristic speech. Kept waiting. What are you talking about? The only thing that has come out, Mesa's lawyer has said that there's nothing else going on. Folks that we've talked with at Tufts said they're not aware of anything else going on. The president of Tufts University said the same. So it seems to be just the fact that she had something to do with this op-ed piece. That was what ICE officials used to determine that she no longer deserved to be here. Given that clear threat, we decided that we maybe rethink some of the traditional sort of rules and principles that we've long talked about. And our partners also have stressed in teaching young journalists. It's been our standard policy to really caution young journalists us about using anonymous sources. There's real risks involved there. It's a trade-off. You're trading off some of the accuracy and the transparency in your journalism when you're using anonymous sources. But we just felt that given the fact that we have a very clear risk that's now being articulated by the U.S. government, I mean, Marco Rubio said he was very comfortable with what happened. It was consistent with U.S. policy, and it's going to continue. They're going to continue, apparently, looking at student media as part of how they build cases against foreign-born students. So we just felt we needed to say, hey, the things that we may have been saying all along, we still stand by much of it, but it's also, I think, important for you all to reevaluate how you are working with people that may be at serious risk simply by talking to you or by expressing their views. And, you know, we've heard through our legal hotline, it's been nervous. That's the feeling. I mean, it's not just that it's been busy and people are calling and asking, you know, what do we do? But there's just this feeling out there that, you know, yes, something has definitely changed. We are hearing reports. I haven't talked to people specifically myself, but I've talked with reporters that are doing stories on this who have themselves reached out to student media. And one of them said that, you know, she talked with one student paper where two foreign-born staff members, two journalists that were on their staff, have stepped off the student newspaper saying it's just not safe in America to be part of a student newspaper staff if you're a foreign-born student. And it's hard to push back against that. It was not something that we did lightly. A lot of these organizations have been around for more than a century, and they certainly never done anything like this either. So this is an unprecedented sort of move, but during unprecedented times.
Tell me a little bit more about the student newsrooms that are calling you up looking for advice. I'm hearing that some are considering scrubbing their websites of articles that have been written by international students or anonymizing them in some way. Is this happening? And if so, what is the danger here to our right to know, to the free press rights of these students when they're compelled to take these actions in light of these recent detentions?
It's definitely happening, much more widespread than certainly people that are just calling the Student Press Law Center. And students are taking some of these steps on their own. Part of the ethical obligation of a journalist, you know, SPJ code says we need to minimize harm. And I think they are taking that seriously when the harm is just so readily apparent. Takedown requests from anybody that they've ever talked to that might have been involved in an article involving one of these topics that ICE seems to be targeting. Concern from a staff member maybe have either recently or in the past, written stories that they think might be targeted are also among the things that we're seeing. They're asking that their bylines be taken down or removed. It's a huge cost when you start agreeing to some of these things. When you start scrubbing bylines or scrubbing names off of stories, again, you are trading accuracy. You are trading transparency. You're asking your readers to believe you. Rather than just putting it out there and letting the readers judge for themselves, you're asking them to trust you. So it's definitely a trade-off, and it's not a decision to be made lightly. There are some potential legal risks when you are, you know, using anonymous sources that we've talked about for years. But again, I think that the, you know, students are weighing these risks on both sides and kind of come into determination that, hey, we want to keep talking to the students, to those that are most impacted by what's happening right now, by these new policies that are targeting student speech in a way that we have never before seen. At least I've certainly never seen in the 3 decades that I've been doing this. They feel there's a new calculus that's required at this time.
Let's get back to the case of Rumeysa Ozturk, the tough student who's detained, and the statement that we released. I think there might be some that see this arrest as a one-off deportation issue regarding one student who engaged in maybe some controversial speech. But it's more than that, right? And it's not just about the First Amendment rights of non-citizens, but citizens themselves. And it's not just about the protection of these rights for student newsrooms, but frankly, for all of us to not only express ourselves in ways that might be contrary to the opinion of our current administration, but as some would argue, our First Amendment right to associate with and hear from these international students who certainly have an important perspective to share.
They're trying to talk to students that are impacted, and they are being told that we cannot talk to you. We are afraid to talk to you. We cannot share our story unless there is some sort of accommodation made. You know, the choice is, are we just going to ignore this entire population, again, that is being most impacted by this and not have their voices heard? Or are we going to make this trade-off at this time? And so Rumeysa, you know, again, her piece was published a year ago. It was the student group on Tufts campus that called on the university president to divest interest from investments in Israel. And so this op-ed piece just said, yo, follow what the student said, do what the student said. It's time for university to divest. I hearken back to my days in college. I go back to when the big call from a lot of student activists and media was for universities to divest from investments in South Africa during apartheid. It was a big thing. And there was no even talk at that point that that was not fully protected speech. And Ramesses' op-ed piece was fully protected speech. There's not even a sliver of doubt that there was anything other than just 100% protected speech in that op-ed. But because of some pieces in the law that really, I hope we are all recognizing, need to be tightened up and fixed, they are claiming they have these rights to go after foreign-born students. Obviously, there's a lot of pushback on the part of Ramesses. Her attorneys are, you know, pushing back right now. We hope that there's going to be some positive resolution to this. But right now, everybody's alarms are up.
And rightfully so, because we're talking about speech, again, to emphasize speech that is fully protected by the First Amendment, yet these students are being targeted nonetheless. My last question for you, Mike, before we wrap up here, and I know every situation is different, facts on the ground certainly change from one campus to the next, but if you could provide any kind of general advice to those international students that are looking to share their perspective in the pages of a campus newspaper and to the campus press itself that is looking to publish these opinions, knowing that there might be some risk to the student authors, what advice would you give them?
Well, the one thing I hope they don't do is just clam up. I mean, we all suffer if we are not able to hear from them. One of the things I'm hearing from student media is they want to tell those stories. But I think we just all need to realize that the game has changed, and we really do need to go into this with our eyes wide open. Our learning was just speaking of a way when you anonymize information and stuff like that. That's a way perhaps of offering some protection. We're also trying to remind them, you know, that there are ways to do that that are safer and more legally protected than others. And we're happy to continue working with student media through our hotline. You know, if they have any specific questions about their particular situation, we're happy to kind of talk it through. Student media want to tell the story, and I hope that they continue doing so.
Thanks, Mike. And those students looking to get some advice, reach out through your hotline. What's the best way to contact you?
Through our website, splc.org, Student Press Law Center. And yeah, they'll just see a button there that takes them right to the hotline if they need to talk to us.
Thank you, Mike. And thanks for all you do at the Student Press Law Center. Appreciate it.
You betcha. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again for listening to the NEFAC Report. This is the last episode of Season 1 as our semester comes to an end. Thank you for all of your support. Be on the lookout for details about Season 2 soon. This program is produced by the New England First Amendment Coalition in partnership with Roger Williams University's Communities of Hope and under the guidance of Professor Bernardo Mata. Before I give a shout out to all of our student team, I want to say thank you to one of our editors, David Peters. David was an integral part of this program and will be graduating this spring. David, we wish you all the best of luck in your future endeavors. Thank you for all of your help this year. Now for the remainder of our student team who will be returning this fall. Thank you to Matthew Downey for the editing, Anna Pellegrini for promos and program logos, Will Feingold for music, Sarah Price for the show notes, along with Brianna Freisora and Lex Benson Amaranti for the production assistance. Have a great summer, and we'll see you in the fall.